Good morning. This is Darrell Gunter, your host for Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM and streaming on the net at WSOU.net. Boy, I tell you, Leo, you think I would have it down by now, but I'm so happy to have back. You know, Leo Battari has been on our program two times before. He's a multiple author. And today we're going to talk about peer novation, as well as servant leadership, as he's expanded peer innovation to include servant leadership. Leo, welcome back to the program.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Love it.
You know, for those of, who have not heard your previous interviews, which is up on Podbean, they can listen to it. They can download it. It's on Podbean. It's on Spotify, as well as Apple Music. Could you share with our audience about your background, education? Give them a few.
Sure. And I'll tell you, I think it's particularly relevant to what we're going to talk about today, because the work I do with peer advisory groups for CEOs and for teams, really, you know, I would say it grew right out of my graduate program at Seton Hall University. You know, I went through the MASCL program back between 2006, 2008. It was kind of interesting because I graduated college in 1983. So it was a while before I went back to graduate school. And of course, when I was in college and in high school prior to that, you know, education was kind of a solo pursuit, right? The professor or the teacher would be lecturing in the front, and you'd take quizzes and tests, you'd submit papers, you'd be shielding your papers from the other kids in the class or the other adults in the class, right? And but then I'm at Seton Hall and I'm part of this cohort. I'm essentially part of a learning team. So it was this whole notion of collaborative learning, which, by the way, would have been called cheating about 20 years earlier, right? But here we are, we're all learning together, we're helping each other be better. And as a result of that experience, the incredible classmates I had, who I think we all made each other so much better in so many different ways, got me really interested when an opening came up with Vistage. And Vistage is a organization that essentially assembles and facilitates peer advisory groups for CEOs and business leaders around the world. And I thought to myself, wow, what they're doing for CEOs is just like what we did for one another in graduate school. I really want to sign up and learn more about that. So I did, and I was there for 6.5 years. And at the end of my, or near the end of my tenure there, private equity had purchased the firm. Actually, it was late 2012, early 2013. And they had asked me to lead a brand refresh for the company. So, you know, I'm going about that and I'm going around the country and I'm asking CEOs and business leaders, like, how do you learn? How do you grow? How do you bring new thinking to your company? And to a person, they would say, okay, I read books. I have a coach. I hire consultants. I go to events and conferences. I watch TED Talks. Some went to executive development programs at places like Harvard and Stanford. But no one, I mean zero, identified peer advisory groups as even being in their consideration set. So when I was asked to report out to the board of directors on the status of the brand rollout, you know, I also shared with them this experience I was having in the field. And I said, you realize the number of people that could be in a group, which is like enormous audience, and the number of people are, which is a tiny fraction of that. I said, you know, we've been at this at Vistage since 1957. There are other organizations around the world that have been doing this successfully for decades. Yet I think every one of us was basically trying to sell a Mercedes to someone who doesn't even know what a car is. So the idea at that point was to step back, not to write some kind of hardcover brochure about Vistage, but to take a true thought leadership position where we would look at this entire category. And through the generous participation of other organizations that were leading peer groups around the world, we got a real lens into what they did and how they did and what we all did and what made the highest performing peer group so incredibly effective and really powerful. And that was the focus of the first book, The Power of Peers, to really identify what makes these groups so incredibly effective. Basically, just so that we could have someone could go somewhere, at least read about it, and say, okay, if this is for me, I'm going to go find the group that fits my needs. If it's not for me, that's okay too, but at least it won't be that you didn't know about it, right? Or you weren't aware of it. So, and then of course, I've written two books since. And of course, my recent work really takes Obviously, the models and frameworks that evolved in the first book have evolved quite a bit. I've worked with well over 650 peer advisory groups and teams on top of that, since basically late 2016. And so the idea, of course, is in addition to the fact that there are prevailing challenges and some of the models updated, the reality is that what these groups do so well, when you get to the heart of what they do so brilliantly, it is so applicable to high-performing teams in the workplace. And that's the work of peer innovation right now, is to bring that forward, especially with the challenges we face today. So it's great fun. I've never enjoyed anything more in my entire career, and I have Seton Hall University to credit for
Well, that is
that.
great, being that I'm a Seton Hall alum as well. But I find it quite refreshing that your LinkedIn posts, no matter what time of day you're on the airplane, whether you're headed out to your appointment, you're coming back, you're really focused on helping these peer groups to learn the concepts, to apply the concepts. From your vantage point, what has been one of the challenges in trying to get a peer group to start to assume a new identity, if you will?
Well, the good news is that I'm invited into these groups. So I start in a good position in that it's not like I'm trying to, force something on them. These groups have an understanding of where they are. Okay. So in some cases, it could be a brand new group. It's a bunch of people that have joined a peer advisory group and they think they know what they joined, but they're not really quite sure when you consider all the possibilities of how they add value for one another. So I lead a workshop that is essentially an aspirational exercise for them so that they really start exploring and discovering the possibilities for one another. They create clarity about what they expect of themselves and others and where they want to go and how they want to work together. So that becomes great. With groups that have been together a long time, I can tell you the first time I was in front of a group, they had been together, I think, 17 years. Some of the founding members were still there. And of course, I'm standing in front of the room saying, "Hey, we're going to work on the group today." And they're looking at me like, "Really? I think
Really?
we kind of got this by now, you know?" Well, the good result of that, and the good news for that whole engagement, though, is what I learned is actually the longer the group has been together and the better they understand all of this, the more opportunities they see for themselves to improve. They know they have a really good, they have really good clarity about what that can look like. So when you're working with a really experienced group, it's really fun to help them kind of rediscover the energy that they know they can bring to the table. And you combine that with the experience they have, and you can get some extraordinary results. So generally, I'm working with groups, whether they're brand new, or whether they've been at it a very long time, who have that beginner's mind, who have that open growth mindset that we all like to talk about. And so that makes my job a lot easier. And the same holds true with teams. When companies bring me in, it's not because they say, "Oh, everything we're doing is great already." Right. They're looking for some guidance. That's either to take a team that's struggling and to help them through that, or it's to take a team that's performing well, but they want to challenge them to be even better. And they want to challenge one another. And when you get great teams like that, again, they see those opportunities and it's fun stuff.
Now, your workshop, is it one day or 2 days?
It's typically about a half day.
Half day. Okay.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, I can do it. Now, sometimes when I've worked with companies, I will go there and it'll be part of an all-day strategic session, for example. So I'll be there. I will, of course, interview some of the leaders and get a real sense of the company before I get there. Then I'll spend the morning with them and I really get to watch them engage and interact and get a sense of what the dynamics are there. And then I can go into the afternoon session and I think be in a pretty good position to, sometimes we call these things, group assessments or team assessments. I'm not assessing anything. All I do is provide them with the framework to assess themselves. And what comes forward is what their, what their aspirations and goals are.
That's a very good lead into my next question, which is how does the group measure success of your program? Because you're
Yeah,
there
it's a great.
for a day and then you're back on the plane.
So, great question. So, for let's take this one at a time. So, for new groups, one of the reasons that organizations have me, and Vistage in particular, has me come to their groups is because when they launch a group, they have to launch a group with 8 members. What they've learned is when they go through my workshop, they go from 8 to 12 faster than without it.
Wow.
So again, it becomes very empowering. It becomes very unifying. And the group starts to understand that our fate, our ability to be great, isn't up to the person leading the group. It's up to all of us. And they, once you recognize that and you unleash that, then they can really do some great things. You know, in other cases, groups that have been around a while have different circumstances. Maybe there's been some attrition and a bunch of new members joined recently. So all of a sudden now it's almost like a new group. Or you've got attendance problems, or you've got any number of things that they're looking to kind of shore up. And just again, it's really about saying, hey, what do I expect of myself as a member? What do I expect of the other members? Let's look one another in the eye and say, let's show up and bring our A game, each and every time. And that is just something that they rally around. But again, what those things are specifically tend to be things they agree to be important to them.
Right. It's very interesting about Visage because you have, let's say, a group of 12 people, but they're all from different industries. So they're not concerned about, industry trade secrets, so to speak,
Right.
for that. And so as a group, what are some of the common goals that you see that a group sets so that they can get the most out of the time that they have together?
Well, first of all, to your point, they recognize that even though they're from very different industries, they have a whole lot of common challenges. First of all, they have a common responsibility. So let's say when you're in a CEO peer advisory group, you recognize that they are sitting in that chair, right? And they don't have the luxury of looking at any situation only through a sales, finance, legal, HR lens. They've got to look at all of it, right? With all the responsibility that goes with that. And I think there's something to be said for the empathy that exists around the room. For even though you're running a different kind of company than I am, you are saddled with that same responsibility, that same pressure, those same expectations from clients, customers, vendors, shareholders, whatever it may happen to be, right? So that becomes, really important. And then, of course, I think there's a couple things. One, and in fact, I just wrote a piece that's going to appear in CEO World in the next day or so on
I
the
love your
importance of,
articles, by the way. They're all
oh.
out on.
Well, one of them is just simply on preparation. It's fascinating. So again, this was discovered by going to a bunch of groups that have been together a while, and I'd watch them through their check-in, and they'd how kind of the check-in goes at these groups. There's like, or they used to be, they do it electronically a lot now, but back in the day, which gave me a better lens into this, they would identify, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, where am I personally, professionally, and in business, right? And then they'd have to identify a topic that they might want to bring to the group. Could be an opportunity, challenge, some decision they've got to make. And then they mark it typically as an A, B, or C issue, A being most important, C being, let's say, least important. But what happened is people would come into the room and they'd form a big line. And the reason the line kept forming is because everyone would go, okay, I'm an 8, I'm a 7, I'm a 9. And then they'd stand there for a moment because they haven't given a lick of thought to what they want to bring to the group. And then what do? They put something in there, they fill in, the blank rectangle that's on the sheet. Then they mark it as a C issue when they sit down. Well, that's hardly a recipe for any kind of valuable interaction on members when that's happening, right? So just the idea of spending what is no more than about 15 or 20 minutes preparing for the meetings, because members after a while were admitting, this is the least prepared I show up to any meeting on my calendar.
Ooh.
That they would never go to a board meeting, staff meeting, client
Sure.
meeting, or anything like that without being really buttoned up and ready to go. And what they recognized was, wow, we're not showing up that way. We own our own companies. We think, hey, we can just come in here and that's that. And then the reality, by the way, is when that conversation takes place and they realize that they're all looking at each other like, yeah, I don't prepare either, they'll point to one person in the room typically, and they'll say, like, Darrell, you are better prepared than anybody every month. How long does that take you? And again, I rarely hear any more than 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes at the most. And they do three things, right? They just look at their stuff from the last meeting to make sure if they kind of keep the continuity if anything has to be brought forward. They look at the agenda for this meeting. If applicable, they're talking about the speaker, and they're definitely spending a little time thinking about what it is they want to bring to the group. And then, of course, last but not least, and what's really helpful is just to clear your head a little bit, right? There's a lot of stuff going on back at your company. How can I kind of clear the decks in my head mentally so I can show up and be truly present for the people here? So I think you look at things like that. And also, I think last but not least, oftentimes it's kind of interesting when, and this is a very obvious one, but oftentimes there's a lack of clarity about what each of the members is truly there for. And when you ask them the question, they'll say, "Well, I'm there to get a different perspective and to have someone point out my blind spots and to be challenged, all that kind of stuff." And I'm like, no. I want to know, how do you want to be a better leader next year? How do you want your team or your company to be better? And how do you want the leader of the group, the leader of the forum, and the chair to help you make that possible?" Now that takes a little effort. Now you've got to really think through the specifics of that. And
Yes.
they make that visible, obviously, too, and they discuss it with, in the case of Vistage, it's your chair, with the case of others, forum leaders and all that, whomever is leading the peer group. And once they gain clarity about what that is, so for the leader of the group, they know how to help them. For the person who's the member, they know what success looks like at the end of the year, with that. But beyond that, you want to create a level of transparency among all the members. So if you and I are in the same group, Darrell, you're really clear on what I'm looking to do in 2024. So you're going to run across an article or a podcast or something like that, and you say, "Boy, Leo would love this." Boom. And
Exactly.
you can send it over to me, right? Without that, I don't know. I'm going from one meeting to the next, and I'm not really clear on how we should be helping everyone. So, it sounds obvious, but oftentimes we don't stop down and have those conversations. We lack a certain intentionality about
Exactly.
doing those things. And I think it's so true in our teams as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are here with Mr. Leo Battari. He is the author of Peer Innovation, and now we're going to jump into servant leadership, which, of course, he learned that. Well, I'm sure he probably knew it before Seton Hall, but Seton Hall enhanced that. So, can you define for our audience what is servant leadership and why is it important?
When servant leadership was first introduced by Robert K. Greenleaf back in 1970. Now, Robert Greenleaf was a former AT&T executive. Actually, he was there about 38 years. And upon leaving, what he realized was, of course, back in those days, it was very command and control leadership, right? Not unlike, by the way, how we were parented back then, right? You were a kid. If you were told to do something, you didn't ask questions. You just said, "All right, yeah, because I told you." That's it. And we went into companies and kind of the same thing. Robert Greenleaf was like, "Wait a second now. There's got to be a better way to do this." And he was talking about this not as the leader first, leader as hero. He was most certainly looking at it as, the leader is there to serve the team, not the other way around. The team is not there just to make the leader look good. So it's this idea of, how do I, as a leader, really pay attention to my people? And not just for the task at hand and what they're there to do at the office, but for them as whole individuals. And how do we help them learn and grow and be their best selves in every part of life? And that if leaders do that and do it really effectively, that they'll get an incredible amount from their team. Now, of course, back then, this whole idea of servant leadership was an oxymoron, right? How could I be a leader and a servant? That doesn't make any sense. But it's so funny how today, here we are more than 50 years later, and you have, for example, Peter Senge. He's got a great video where he talks about his favorite definition of leadership. And he says it's the capacity of a human community to shape its future. Now, what I find interesting about this is he's not defining servant leadership. He's defining leadership as servant leadership when you really think about it, right? So while the idea of servant leadership and the leader serving the team was anathema to the way anyone talked about leadership Back then, it has certainly become far more mainstream right now. You've got companies, whether it's the Starbucks, the FedExes of the world, Container Store. I mean, there's a whole host of companies today that at some level employ servant leadership, recognizing how important it is. And by the way, in the nick of time in many respects, because we get millennials and Gen Zs in the workplace. 64% of the workforce is going to be millennials and Gen Zs by 2025, and it'll be 75% by 2030. These folks enjoyed a very different relationship with their parents than you and I did. So what that's why when they're in the workplace, they want a lot of feedback. They want a lot of dialogue. They want to know how they're doing. They want to know how what I do connects to the company's why. They want to know where am I going in this organization? How can I learn? So all of these things are really coming together. And where this connects with peer innovation is that because we as leaders, we can't just look at our organizations vertically, right? We've got our executive leadership team and our senior VPs and VPs and directors and managers and all that. The reality is of what runs horizontally through the team gives that vertical structure strength. In 2019, Edelman Trust Barometer asked a very specific question when they were looking at this idea of trust at work. And they basically asked, how do you find out what is really happening at your company? And the answer, topping the list out of all of the ways, all of the sources of information people could get, topping the list was informally from my coworkers. Now, think about the way they asked the question. It doesn't mean that's where they first heard the information. They probably heard it in an announcement or an email or an all-staff meeting or whatever it happened to be, but it is where they find out what it means. People in organizations don't just take in, if someone announces a new policy, a new strategy, some new, change initiative of some kind. It's not like they just take that information and go about their business and that's it. They engage one another in sense-making exercises to ask, is this good for us, bad for us? What do we think about this? What does this start to look like? So I often mention to these leaders that part of leading horizontally is identifying who are those key influencers in your company who may not have the loftiest title, but they're really influential with other employees. Now you start thinking about, okay, maybe I can get some valuable input from these folks on the substance of what we're trying to do, maybe on the messaging, maybe on how we deliver that message. Short of all that, you want to be make sure that they certainly understand the why behind what you're doing, because not if, but when those sense-making exercises take place, you want at least something to, you want people, you want some voices there that can be helpful. And I say this in large part too, because even though there's all these stats all around, some of them, are suspect, but I think the reality is that most people do, I think, tend to agree that most change initiatives fail or underperform. A big reason for that, according to McKinsey and others, is not that the policy was so bad or the strategy was so ill-conceived. It's because you couldn't get the people behind it to the degree necessary to give it a fair shake. So all we're really asking for people to do is let's make sure that the right information is getting out about what we're doing and why, and let's give it a fair try. And you know what? If it doesn't work, we pivot and we try something else, and that's okay.
Why do you think that some companies, some leaders, don't test that message horizontally in advance, just to say, by the way, I'm thinking about this to do this way. What do you think? To people who really they own the water cooler, right?
They do. First of all, in many cases, they think they know better. And second, they believe it takes too much time. The reality is that it might take you more time to launch whatever change you want to do, but it will actually take you less time for it actually to be successful. If you, it's kind of like if I were driving a school bus and I decided to take off with only like 25% of the kids who were supposed to be in the bus and I left everyone else behind. Well, that's not going to be a great idea. Those kids aren't going to make it, or I got to come back for them or something like that, right? So I want everybody on board or as best I can. And now we're going to go forward together. And sure, getting everyone on board to go forward together and get their buy-in can take a little extra time. But you know what? In the long run, you're far better off.
Servant leadership In the class I teach at Seton Hall, I focus a lot on Daniel Goldstein and in regards to emotional intelligence and whatnot. Do you find that some folks, just some leaders, just don't have the emotional intelligence to embrace social leadership? And if so, how can they address their shortcoming?
Yeah, and I think emotional intelligence, continues to be an important part of the equation here, right? Just to have that self-awareness, just for starters. So yeah, I think I agree with you 100%. I think it can be a real issue, and it's when I think about what we do with all of this, whether it's servant leadership or peer innovation or emotional intelligence and all that, what we know is that it's not for everybody. We do. It just, I'd like to think it could be, or it should be, maybe, but it isn't. And there's some people that have a very difficult time just wrapping their heads around that. And what's difficult too is that you've had people who have been through their entire career, maybe kind of a command and control leader, right? Maybe, leading power cultures more than anything else. And they've been successful. So in their minds, it's like, now you're telling me I got to change. I got to go about this all differently and everything. It's like, why? It's out of my comfort zone.
Wow.
So.
Leo, our time always flies by, and I have time for one last question, but I want to give you the floor to share your thoughts about peer innovation and servant leadership.
Sure. I just think they go hand in hand. I think the idea of a leader who, as Senge says, recognizes the capacity of a human community to shape its future is very powerful. And I think as a leader, and I think it takes a strong leader to do it, the more that we can understand and nourish the gifts of the people that we're leading and what that can mean and how and what they mean to one another, as well as to the leader or to the company, becomes really important. I mean, think about sports teams, think about the military on the battlefield or whatever. They are there for one another. They have each other's back. And, when push comes to shove, I mean, that's kind of what it's all about. So I think they go hand in hand, certainly. And I just think that when you start looking at how people see their workplaces today, when you look at the generations of leadership and what their expectations, excuse me, the generations of leaders and employees, by the way, throughout the organizations today, who will be populating the workforce. I think everything we're talking about right now is just kind of leaning into not only where we are now, but where the world's going.
I can sneak in one more question, and
Sure.
that question is around this Gen Z generation that you talked about and the 4-day work week. How do you think that's going to work out? Because I see a lot of companies are really thinking about a 4-day work week.
Any type of thing like this, it's like almost asking people, what do you think of fully remote work? Or what do you think of hybrid? Or what do you think of this? It's going to work some places, not going to work other places. I mean, just, it's just kind of as simple as that. They will create for themselves a culture where they can really be successful at it, or others will struggle with it. And so, and there'll be a lot of experimentation. There'll be a lot of trial and error along the way. But, I think these kinds of things are certainly worth exploring and worth entertaining, right? So,
So, Leo, how can someone get in touch with you?
absolutely connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm there. And also, if you go to peerinnovation.biz just to learn more about our work, not just with peer advisory groups and forums, but what we do with teams around the world, we'd love to talk with you about it.
So, I am waiting for the Peer Innovation Conference. When is it coming?
We'll see. Well, I don't have a conference plan at the moment, but I do want this term, if you will, this concept, this idea to be similar to emotional intelligence or psychological safety, that
Absolutely.
people will see peer innovation for what it is, in terms of what it means. So, yeah.
Well, Leo, I want to thank you for coming on the program. I always learn so much from you.
I loved it. Thanks so much, Jarrell. Anytime.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, that wraps it up this week on Leadership with Darrell W. Gunter with our guest, Mr. Leo Bertari, who is the author of Pure Innovation. And that wraps it up for this week. But we want to wish you have a very good weekend. But remember, leadership begins with you.